There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and John Cross of The Daily Mirror. 18 wins on the bounce, 10 points clear at the top of the Premier League, 4 trophies within sight. Manchester City have picked up more league points in 2021, 33, than Liverpool, Spurs and Arsenal combined. They don't so much resemble a football team as a force of nature. They're on Champions League business this week against Borussia Mönchengladbach. But John, you were at the Emirates yesterday. Is this shaping into Pep's signature season?
Yes, it is. And it has all the potential, I think, to do so. I must say, I'm someone now that has become slightly nervous about tipping Man City for the Champions League, simply because I think I've been there before when I think they are by far and away the best team in Europe right now, playing the best football with arguably the best squad around. And I just think they're an absolute joy to watch. But we've been here before. You know, we've been here in situations where I think they've been in equally good shape and they've done some crazy things, whether it be Fabian Delph at fullback or suddenly moving Gabriel Jesus to wing back. And Pep, sometimes it feels like, has been trying to be too smart for his own good. But I just think he's found this amazing system yesterday. I mean, it was highlighted for me, I think. Mikel Arteta said pre-match, he said, I think Pep Guardiola's found his perfect system, and it's his perfect system today where he doesn't have to play a striker. I mean, it's just amazing how We used to think that, I don't know, until about 10 years ago, we used to think that playing a false nine was something quirky in England. But now I just think it is City's dream setup, basically. I mean, don't get me wrong, he just has his moments. Aguero's now being back on the bench, isn't he? But I just think that City are the all-encompassing total football team that pass it around and can beat anyone but with that system and style. And I think that there'll be a match for anyone, but they do still worry me. I fully expect them to kind of do that clean sweep again, because they're so far ahead of everyone else, I think, Premier League terms, domestic terms, so they can win all domestic trophies. But they really should win the Champions League. This should be their year. This should be their opportunity. But they've slightly nibbled away at my faith, and they slightly worry me. I didn't think they'd come back, if I'm honest, in mid-December. I never thought they'd hit these levels again, even though they were hinting at playing such good football again. So I'd love to be proved wrong, because I'm just such a huge admirer of them. I think we're watching one of the truly great teams in English football history, but I'm still slightly nervous just because of their mess-ups from even better places before, I think.
To amplify that point, Migs, do we struggle to understand how good this team is? Because the opposition are almost subconsciously, it seems, accepting their fate. So you've got matches like the game that, you know, you were at the Emirates as well yesterday, where it pretty much resembled a sparring session after the early goal.
It feels like that's going to be the story of the season from here on in. And I mean, this used to happen with Manchester United in the 90s, a few times in the 2000s, where teams almost accept their fate. And it's a bit of a training session for City, with that, I suppose, an extra bit of symbolism to that, given Arteta's former coach. He was setting out Collins for Pep again yesterday, and they just passed around them. But no, I do fear that could be the case for all of the season. At the moment, it's impossible to know when this run is going to end. And it's hard to see where it's going to end. I think Guardiola does deserve credit there. And I agree with Crossy in that mid-early December, it didn't look like this was possible. But I think even more pointedly, when they lost that game to Spurs, White Hart Lane, around that period, it did look like this could be that Pep was into this situation that we've seen for so many managers. A cycle had ended, like it happened to Pochettino with Spurs. It was as if he was trying to build another team and it was just proving too difficult. And there were a lot of murmurs at that time about the players being fatigued with like his intensity. Just they kind of fancy to change. But even in that regard, it's no like what like Guardiola's almost as famous for anything else as all those trophies as his histrionics on the line. Whereas at the moment, he doesn't look agitated on the line at all now. In fact, he was so like I was just sitting very close to him yesterday from my position in the press box at Arsenal. And he was so calm. And by the same token, it is as if this season he's took a step back, looked at the rigors of the schedule and how complicated this season is, and basically adjusted his team to play within that. I wrote a few weeks ago, City have figured out pandemic football. And one of the ways is he's worked out a way to have this balanced defence with a team that can really hurt you in so many areas. And like even with Arsenal yesterday, you would think City are susceptible to the break and players like Saka bursting forward, but they're not. There's very little space to break into. But equally, that can't be detached from the fact, look at the performance of John Stones. A lot of other clubs, given the wages he's on and he's barely used in the past few years, he would have been drummed out, or they would have had to sell him on. City don't have those needs. And it's not a surprise that one of the clubs that can withstand this crisis and go on a run that was supposed to be impossible this season is one of their resources, and that is essentially a state-backed club.
Yeah, that speaks to the broader point, doesn't it, John? Is this nature of elite competition changing? You know, even before we get into the distortion of this new Champions League, the bloated Champions League that's being talked about in 2024, who can actually challenge the state clubs? And by that, I mean City and PSG.
Well, I think Liverpool can. Listen, I think Leicester will finish in the top four. I think Manchester United, frankly, are a work in progress. I don't see it as complete submission to that. I mean, I just feel, you know, PSG have suddenly become exciting through Maurizio Pochettino taking over there. The result at Barcelona was something else. We've all seen the stories about Real Madrid and sort of potential Saudi investment there. Other clubs are clearly trying to sort of catch up. But I have to say, it's obvious, isn't it, that basically we've rather pressed the reset button on UEFA's fair play rules, really. And since City took them on, I just can't see that they're basically worth the paper they're written on. And they're kind of, it feels like they're in limbo anyway because of the pandemic and basically owners being given carte blanche to spend, frankly. And so I do think that we might as well sort of call a halt on them. I always thought they were a false barrier anyway, to be honest. I really didn't like them. I didn't appreciate them. But I have to say, I think that Man City, I it might be an unpopular view here, but I'm a huge Manchester City fan. I'm a fan of the way that they've raised the bar under Pep Guardiola. I'm a huge fan of the way that they inspired Liverpool's improvement, because they did. They had a point to proving that. They're setting new records. They're playing some of the best football around. And listen, they have improved vast parts of the local community as well. I'm sounding like a Manchester City salesman and brochure here. But I'm quite a huge advocate of them. Listen, I get the drawbacks. Please don't get me wrong. I get the negatives. I get the argument. But I kind of like, and I look on with admiration for what they've done for football.
Well, the one thing I pick up on the local community, I mean, the common argument is that, I know we're getting into deeper issues here, but the line commonly said is that the regeneration stops at the border of the Etihad campus. And essentially, it's almost as if they've used the club for Abu Dhabi to build a construction empire in Manchester, which is mostly luxury flats rather than kind of affordable housing. So, I mean, there are bigger issues there. And in terms of raising the bar and what it's going to do for football, this is where it really worries me, because we could have a second treble in three seasons. I don't think that's a case of raising the bar. I think that's distorting competition, because I just don't, and even clubs like Liverpool, and like, to a degree this season points to, although it's sort of its divorce, you can only push, when it comes down to resources, clubs can only push their limits for so long, and then eventually there is, I mean, we saw it, to be fair, on a different scale, a different time, we saw it with United for quite a while, where they'd see off pretty much every challenger until Chelsea were bought out by Abramovich. And this is what I think we could, but my fear is we could come back to look at this period as one where the great variety and competitive balance of the Champions League, or sorry, of the Premier League, started to be eroded. Well, let's see how it goes. And again, like, I mean, the fact that Guardiola came back this season the way he did wasn't itself a surprise, which does speak to some of the unpredictability to this. But if in 3-4 years' time we have a situation where City are again winning the League Cup every season as well as the title, and it's 7 out of 8, then I think, you know, we won't be looking at it as fondly.
The scary prospect, or scary for their opposition at the very least, is that this City team is still evolving. Guardiola is probably evolving as a coach. He seems to have taken a lot from his mentor, Wijnaldum, this season. You add in Haaland to that team next season, and you've got a dynasty there, haven't you, John?
Yeah, Haaland is a really exciting prospect. And I know, despite all the on-the-record denials, I do still think there might be something in Lionel Messi. But
do they need Messi, John?
Well, the only thing I think about Messi is there's such a great team to watch, and there's such a total football team, that I sometimes wonder, do they need a focal point of a centre-forward? And I still think, despite Haaland's movement and despite him being absolutely typical kind of focal point centre forward, number 9, if you like, I still think that he's more of that mould than Messi. But I actually think that City are in a position where, if you actually look at it logically, and the amount of players that they are missing and short of, and perhaps they could do them both. I mean, Messi would be just a fabulous signing for the Premier League, in my view, simply because I just think he would be a great adventure, and also still the best player in the world, arguably, to come over to English football. We've not had that for quite a long time, despite all everyone saying, you know, I think it is, the Premier League is fabulous league, fabulous competition. We really needed we haven't had the best player in the world, I don't think, since Ronaldo left for Real Madrid all those years ago. So I think that would be a signature signing, and I think his movement and would play into City's style at the moment, because I think that's moved away from having that focal point centre-forward. I think Haaland has got so much potential and so much scope for improvement, and he's already such an exciting talent that he could be easily the best striker in Europe for the next 8 years or something like that, really. He's just got such an enticing player to get. I'm just amazed that, you know, we all know about the history of his arrival at Dortmund, but I was amazed there wasn't more clamour for him when he actually moved in the original place. But I do think that City will surely have to strengthen again. But it feels like they've been back to their smart signings, because Ruben Diaz has transformed them. Cancelo's taken a while, but has actually proved to be a really shrewd signing. And I just think that basically they've needed something up front for a while. And I mean, the scary thing is that they're so dominant now. If they go and improve, where's the chance for anyone else? But I personally think that's quite an enticing prospect.
Aren't we looking, Migs, at, like, if we look at this week's tie against Mönchengladbach, does that game or that tie almost capture the institutionalised inequality of European competition as we know it now, let alone in the future? You've got Marco Rose he's off to Dortmund to manage them at the end of the season. You've got bigger clubs, including Chelsea, we're told, sniffing around Jonas Hofmann, their midfield player. It's almost, you know, we're at an exalted level of European competition here, the last 16 of the Champions League, and City are essentially playing a selling club.
Yeah, I mean, and also I did something this a while back where if you look at the speed at which clubs are stripped now, it's much faster. So Ajax 95, it actually, for all, I mean, that happened just before the Bosman came in, but it still took 4 to 5 years for the core of that team to go, and another between 1 and 2 even to lose some of their best players. So they got to the final the year after 95. Now, these days, Ajax 2019, the closest they've come to a final since, pretty much all of that team, all of the key players were gone within a year, bar Ziyech. So teams, if any sort of club like that, any sort of outsider club gets any sort of success within one season, it's pretty much done. They don't even get the time to kind of go and, you know, possibly achieve or challenge what they should, because all the vultures are already in. And yeah, and it's been points to kind of a long-running issue that we discussed in the show as well, where the reason that we're talking about this big transformation of the Champions League and change in structure, it isn't because of any problem with the actual structure of Champions League. A 32-team event with 8 groups of 4, symmetrically it's fine, it should work perfectly, but the problem is the huge inequality between clubs, which means the first few months of the competition, the group stage, are a joke. And they can't address that that disparity, so they have to find all these ways around it, which is possibly this strange Swiss-style system. And ultimately, where they hope the ties we watch at this point of the season aren't really kind of what we presume is going to be a one-sided affair, like City, Gladbach, and more kind of Barcelona-PSGs. Although I think as we're going to come on to this, the Spanish clubs could have a few problems over the next few years themselves.
Well, that's it. Are clubs in Italy and Spain in danger of falling behind, you think, John? Because look at Bayern, for instance. You know, by common consent, they're probably closest challengers to City at the moment. They're at Lazio on Tuesday. Spanish clubs, I think 3 Spanish teams last week conceded 11 goals in their home European ties, wherever they were played. What about the wider significance of the way that the game is actually splintering across the continent?
Yeah, I do think that is a concern. I mean, I don't think we should forget that I watched Bayern throughout last season, so we're only talking a year ago, competition. And to my mind, they were as dominant in European football terms as Manchester City are now. Bayern looked very, very good from early on. And then when Liverpool went out and clearly had their minds elsewhere, I would argue, on sort of the Premier League, then Bayern was so obviously the best team in Europe. And Spanish football has clearly been, for so long, nervous about their own position. And they've been the big agitators, haven't they, in a breakaway of their own. Listen, I think that the Swiss model has actually got big potential. I think the reshaping of this has got major potential, with also very obvious major flaws, in that basically that they're trying to impose a self-protection here of their own position, so that they qualify year on, year in, year out. But you know, whether that's through kind of reaching that first, you know, going beyond the first knockout stage, if you like, or kind of qualifying for the second round. But I do think we are witnessing a lot of dead group games here. I think we had a glimpse of the future last season, when I think the final stages of that tournament, when it was one-off games in the Europa League and Champions League. If we cannot see that maybe European football needs a little bit of a shake-up, because that was so good, that was so entertaining, that was so amazing. And I know it was unprecedented circumstances and one-offs, and we'd never see that again. Well, we should do, because that was brilliant TV, brilliant entertainment, fabulous. And I just think that whether that leads into a splinter tournament for UEFA or however it might be, then I think it's a shame. But I still think there's so many hurdles. It's like everyone's presenting this thing as UEFA are putting forward their proposals and everyone will accept it, and it plays into what the European Clubs Association want. I don't see it like that at all. I think the European Clubs Association still want more power. They still want more say, and they do not want UEFA to be both the regulator and the commercial partners. They're the ones that are putting in the risk, as they see it. They're the ones that are attracting the big TV deals. So why should UEFA be trying to sort of jump on this and control both? No wonder UEFA want to champion it and push it through very quickly, but I don't see that it will be. UEFA are trying to get all the leagues on board for their plan, but the ECA are not, have not signed up, as I understand it, to these proposals in their current form, largely because they don't agree with the way that UEFA are trying to sort of govern it completely. I think they've had enough of UEFA trying to be the all-encompassing, all-controlling body.
But I suppose it begs the question, Migs, who should run the game? What is the game run for, or who is it run for? At the moment, you've just got the big clubs throwing their weight around.
Well, this is it. I mean, and I think there is always an issue where UEFA are supposed to be the safeguard of the game, yet at the same time, they're also technically in competition with bodies like the Premier League, like FIFA. I mean, the Champions League is ultimately competing for the same sort of kind of sponsorship deals and the rest as other competition. And that does create a little bit of tension there. But at the same time, I would say UEFA's running of the game is genuinely, and certainly in the last 2-3 years, is an attempt to safeguard and protect the wider game. And what's like, I mean, the real problem when the big clubs talk about how they're the ones that bring the money in, this is something I have a real issue with, because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and becomes about who's good at the right time. If we were having this discussion in the 1990s, when Nantes were winning the French League and suddenly, you know, really taking Juventus close in the semi-finals of the Champions League, Nantes could be one of Europe's biggest clubs. That is an exaggeration. There's a certain amount of luck. But because we're in an era where football has basically embraced every single capitalistic measure possible, where there's so little safeguards for football, there's so little checks and balances, we have this cycle where this certain group of clubs do well at a certain time that attracts more money, which makes the and more TV deals at the moment, obviously, and better prize money, which allows them to strengthen, which brings more fans, which brings more money, which makes them stronger, to the point where we have this situation where there's this immense disparity, where there's 9 clubs with a revenue of 400 million and a load of them that can't really get close. And then you have these, like a club like Dortmund, who are one of Germany's great clubs, so many titles. And what are they? They're a little bit of a husk. I mean, they're all well-run, all the rest of it, but they're still a bit of a husk whose main purpose at this point is bringing through young players and ultimately selling them off rather than actually competing. And that is a direct consequence of the situation we're talking about here, and big clubs throwing their weight around. And the only thing that's actually driving it is greed. I would say at least UEFA's, for all the issues that Crossy's raised about, you know, how the big clubs see UEFA and that, I think UEFA are at least trying to preserve a competition with a bit of competitive balance and a bit of variety around Europe, whereas the big clubs aren't. They just want to preserve their place. And another classic indication of this issue is, alongside these discussions for the 2024 restructuring of the Champions League, there's also discussions about prize money and where the money from the Champions League is actually going to go. Because this is a major issue, because the Champions League prize money is one of the biggest drivers of financial disparity in Europe, because all the clubs in the competition become so wealthy. Well, in the last round of negotiations, I think the figure to be given out, the solidarity figure basically, to be given the clubs not in Europe, so they don't completely get stripped away, was 8.5%. Now, the European leagues wanted to boost that money up to 20% to make a more equitable Europe. And, you know, that sounds quite sensible, really, because it prevents this situation. What actually happened was the big clubs flexed their weight. It dropped further, I think, to just over 7%. And that's the situation we're in, where just this group of clubs is just accumulating more and more money and become more and more box office. And it does depress me that, even if you look at this week, it was pointed out how Mbappe was the first player since Andrei Shevchenko to score a hat-trick at the Camp Nou. Well, that situation is almost impossible now, because A, that was a night when Dynamo Kiev battered Barca 4-0 Camp Nou. But, you know, in today's game, Shevchenko wouldn't still be there. Kiev would be, again, a bit of a husk of a team. And it does depress me that, like, even in the late 90s, when a lot of these problems started, there was a real variety to the Champions League. There was a bit, like, there were so many clubs that could become good. There were a lot of exciting clubs who would now be considered unfashionable. And that's just not really possible now. And if anyone does become good for any brief period of time, then they'll be ripped apart within a year.
Yeah. You see, I'm getting a sense of, how can I put it, elegant desperation, John. If you look at Real Madrid, who actually, when you think about it, are possibly quite vulnerable this week against Atalanta. Mm. As you mentioned earlier on, you know, they're looking for money from Saudi Arabia. £130 million sponsorship's been spoken of. That, to me, is a big sign of changing times. Do you think Saudi Arabia will be the next state to fund a team?
Well, absolutely, if they have their way, without a shadow of doubt. It is interesting at the moment, isn't it, that basically there's a lot of controversy surrounding Saudi Arabia. It comes out when the spotlight is shining so brightly at the moment on that in terms of news. We've seen that in the past week or so, haven't we? It's interesting, even at the moment, we keep on being reminded that sort of the Queen now doesn't like to be pictured with Sheikh Mohammed, you know, sort of because of the controversy over his daughter. But it's just, there's no doubt about it. It springs up controversy, and it's not one that's very sort of kind of appetizing here. But I have to say, if we go back even to sort of the potential investment into Newcastle, I don't think was in any way stopped because over a moral issue in many ways, over the behaviour of potential investors there. It really wasn't. And also, by the way, where do you draw the line on potential investment? It was purely done because, I think, of the TV and the piracy issue, which they just couldn't stomach. They could stomach other things, but they wouldn't stomach the TV rights being sold down the river. Well... Sorry, but that says it all, really. So clubs, I think, are not going to be shy. They're not going to be afraid to take over investment that helps them to punch in a level playing field, really. But I just think we've got to be rather careful, I think, over taking the moral judgment here. Please, this is not me advocating the behaviour and scruples of any nation in the world. But I do think, where on earth do you draw the line? And that's the issue. Do we want to see... Listen, when we talk about the kind of the level playing field, I guess you're absolutely right. We don't want to see a Champions League dominated by one club for a decade, do we? We also don't want to see a Premier League that's completely dominated by just one team. It is being dominated by Manchester City at the moment. But having said that, let's talk about last season, when it's very, very difficult, I think, to dominate the Premier League for more than 3 years just because of the huge demands on it. And I still think that that's still quite a long way off. But I do think we've got to be careful, clearly, in terms of investment and in terms of where we go. I think Real Madrid are desperate because they are in such a mess. Look at their team. Mm. You know, it's just a joke of a team now. They used to be... I'm someone who watches a hell of a lot of European football and sort of Spanish football, and I love it. And there's been points in time when Real Madrid have Barcelona. You could name their team as a world-class starting 11 off the top of your head. But where do you start now with A, Barcelona, and B, Real Madrid? I mean, they're both two teams in such an unbelievable mess. And they are desperate because they've made several bad decisions. And yet Real Madrid just went on this sort of kind of fantasy reunion with Zidane and probably do something again similar if it goes too much further wrong for themselves in Europe. And that's the plain truth of it. But they're desperate because they are, in European terms, falling behind all the big guns. They're no longer considered among the sort of the Champions League favourites at all.
And what brings a lot of this discussion to a head is, and what sums it up, When Paris Saint-Germain went to buy Neymar in 2017, I was like, one of the strategies behind that was they felt, and it was an astronomical fee, you know, they met the buyout, but and the wages were immense. But what I was told was that Paris Saint-Germain realised that that they could basically short squeeze the football market, which is if they drove fees and wage up to a certain point, they knew only a certain amount of clubs could compete. And two of those, obviously, the Manchester clubs, because United have, you know, such a revenue-making machine, and one of them potentially Chelsea, but they didn't consider the Spanish clubs capable of going to that level, basically because their ownership structure, which I think remains one of the positive elements of Spanish football, and two big clubs in that way, in which they're owned by their fans and socios, but that basically prohibited internal or external investment at a time when that's basically shaping the game more than anything. And hence we have Florentino Perez, the Madrid president, pushing for European Super League and also potentially doing these deals with Saudi Arabia because they're looking for any way to make extra money. And I think we could well be in for a fallow period for Spanish football in that sense because there isn't the investment right now.
No, well, interestingly, you know, what we obliged to call the big two in Spain, they're behind Atletico, who are 3 points clear in La Liga, despite having not kept a clean sheet for 7 league games, which I think is the first time in 10 years and certainly the first time under Simeone. They lost 2-0 at Levante at the weekend. There was a bit of comedy gold when Oblak was caught upfield for the decisive second goal. They seem to be in a dip at the wrong time, don't they, John? They're playing Chelsea in Bucharest. What about Chelsea Is Thomas Tuchel starting to impose himself there?
Yeah, he absolutely is. I mean, it wasn't such a great result or performance, indeed, was it Saturday? I have to say, I was a bit sceptical. I just think that Tuchel is so combustible and so combative, really, that I just think at some stage it'll end in tears. I think we all know it, don't we, really? But I do think he's certainly got a reaction, a response from that team. And in the end days of Frank Lampard, you kind of think, he just needs a few games to turn it around, and Chelsea desperately need to get into the top four. And that was the parameters of the engagement, really, wasn't it? I just think that, in retrospect, I do think that Chelsea have got every right to say, look, we were proved right to make the managerial change. We needed a new spark. We needed new invention. It's interesting, isn't it, that kind of one of his first things to do, despite not really always sort of investing in the back three before previously, you know, he's gone back to a back three rather, and just to give Chelsea a bit more solidity. He didn't play particularly well on Saturday, but that was one of their first games where they've slightly dipped away. Calling it on with Hudson-Odoi was really interesting. Basically, really called him out publicly. That was brutal, saying that basically when he brought him on, he basically didn't reach the standards expected and then withdrew him, but then sort of tried to draw a line under it very quickly afterwards. I do think you're seeing a difference in Werner. I think although he's quickly worked out that Werner's so much more effective either playing away from home through the middle or indeed sort of playing wide of a main striker at home. And I just think that he's got Chelsea playing a lot better. I would have said a month or so ago, I thought that Atletico would be very, very clear favourites. They're playing very, very well. I mean, Trippier has been a revelation when he's been available, by the way. I mean, you shouldn't overlook that. That's an amazing story, really. And I just think that I still make Atletico favourites, if I'm honest. I still think that basically they've got some really good players in there, and I still make them just favourites. But I do think now it's available for Chelsea. I think if they play well, they can do it. Whereas I think a month ago, I would have said, no, Atletico will definitely go through.
Do you think we should be asking more questions of Werner, Miggs? I look at him and I just see someone still making poor decisions too often.
There's a bit of that, and that it feels like maybe he's not quite as mature yet as a player as we might have thought when he was signed, that he's still got a bit of developing to do. At the same time, with the positions he gets into, with a willingness, I've never been, even through this run, I've never been overly concerned by him, I have to say. I think he will come good. I mean, there's been cases of this in the past of kind of, I mean, like, remember Andy Cole's his second season at Manchester United in 95, 96, actually, when he was a bit of a joke. And then, of course, goes on to be re-establish himself as one of England's great strikers. And some of actually Werner's form this season has a little bit reminded me of that. Because I do think there is a really high-class forward in there. But at the moment, he needs more polish. He needs to get that. He needs to restore his confidence. And I mean, I was at the Chelsea game on Monday against Newcastle, and there was such a telling moment in that. Like, his face was a story in itself. When he got his goal, then when it looked like it was going to be ruled off, and then it was given. So, like, we had kind of joy to real anxiety and despair to relief all in the space of a few minutes. I do think he'll end up being a very good signing for the club. Whether we see enough of that this season is open to question. Because I think Chelsea have a really decent chance at a Champions League this year. Obviously, the league's beyond them. And Crossy's right. I think Saturday was their first slip in that sense. But I think they've generally been quite solid under Tuchel. But as much as anything, they've got broadly a good approach, even if one they're getting used to. But also they've got massive strength and depth in a congested calendar and in a Champions League season that may actually favour clubs who aren't, you know, in a title race or don't have the same... Chelsea still have a bit of pressure to get top four, but I think they'll end up getting that quite comfortably. And there's another thing about the Champions League in that sense. It's amazing how much, because of the gap between fixtures, how much the complexion can change from one day to the next, and especially from the group stage to the knockout stages. And Atletico are a bit of a strange club in that way as well. I mean, for all Simeone has, I mean, he achieved a miracle winning the title there in 2014. Yeah, it still feels like, I mean, that club is almost the most psychologically neurotic club, with more hang-ups I think that anyone, even more so, I would say, than Everton with Liverpool for 21. I mean, what? Like, if you look at them, Simeone gets them to the Champions League final twice, which is both defeats themselves. And what happens? They end up losing to the club that they hate more than anyone else in the worst possible circumstances, a last-minute equaliser and a penalty shootout. And so they still have a lot of complexes, particularly as regards the Champions League. And just coming to form at a bad form at a slightly wrong time. They're only 3 points ahead of Real Madrid in the title race now as well. It could be there for Chelsea.
When you look at alternative models, John, I always settle on Leicester. You know, they're well-funded, not extravagantly funded, but well-funded. They're brilliantly coached. The recruitment is strategic and, you know, far-sighted. They've got faith in younger players. We saw that the weekend with Luke Thomas, I thought, was exceptional at left-back following the James Justin injury. Should we be taking Leicester more seriously?
As what, though?
Well, I see them as potential winners of the Europa League, for instance.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's funny, isn't it? I was engrossed in sort of all the European action last week. I was lucky enough to have sort of the week off, and so kind of sat back on my sofa and watched literally every game that I possibly could. And it's so weird that basically Leicester was just an afterthought. It was kind of a bit of a footnote. I know it's the least interesting result, arguably, because it's 0-0 away in Prague, and they were playing a team that's running away with the Czech league and the sort of scoring goals for fun, basically. And so it's a half decent result to go back home, and they should go through. But I do think they can win the Europa League and win a European trophy. You immediately then say, though, don't you? Oh yeah, but they'll have to beat Manchester United. Well, I think that frankly, they're playing better football than Man United. I know they're sort of jockeying.
I think they've got a better manager as well
between them. Yeah, absolutely. I think that Brendan Rodgers is such a good coach. I'll be honest. I just can't. I can't believe that there's still so much. I think part of the problem is, guys, I don't know whether you agree, is that basically I do think that Brendan Rodgers still invokes this. Should we be taking him seriously? I was driving home from the Emirates last night, and they're sort of having this discussion over whether sort of Rodgers would see it as a step up or step down to manage Spurs. And it's just, I think the outcome was that it probably at this moment in time it'd be a step down. But honestly, there's so much snobbery over Brendan Rodgers and indeed Leicester. But Brendan Rodgers, I think, is arguably the most exciting and best British coach around. Yeah, I think he does a terrific job with young players and develops teams. He gets them playing such a sort of fluid and way which is full of flair and excitement. And Liverpool came too soon. Life lessons were learned. But I just think, you know, he could have easily gone back to Swansea for the second coming, which would have been a disastrous career decision. And I'm not sure he would have even come back from that. But Celtic, we're seeing now that Celtic's, he won everything, but basically it's still, I think, something to be admired. He sort of regrouped, restructured and came back, and he's doing an amazing job at Leicester. Mm. And I just think that arguably Leicester maybe need to get some silverware or something like that, and the Europa League fits into that category for the rest of the country to sit up and take notice of what is an incredible job I think that he's doing at the King Power. I think in any other season it would be a much more level title race and they would be right in the thick of it. But because City have pulled clear, that then basically we're not even giving them the credit they deserve of being second and third at the moment and making a sort of a fist of it. But I think they don't get the credit or the respect that they deserve.
You know, what I like about Brendan Rodgers is that he seems to be growing both personally and professionally, which brings us on to a certain Jose Mourinho mix. You know, Spurs have got the formality of their return leg in the Europa League on Wednesday. There was just a line that he came up with yesterday about his coaching methods being second to nobody in the world. That's self-delusion on an epic scale, isn't it?
I mean, I saw that and it just struck me as desperation, to be honest. It's basically, he did this at Manchester United towards the end as well, where he went in that strange heritage rant. Well, it wasn't really a rant, I suppose. It was a strange press conference after he got knocked out by Sevilla and started to argue, you know, about his own Champions League legacy against United. And it does just feel like someone grasping at previous success because they can't answer questions about current problems. And it's Spurs and him have a lot of them. This is the worst run of his career. He's never had a spell where he's gone 5 defeats in 6 league games, not even when he was at Leiria, you know, a mid-table Portuguese team. And when he was one of the on the way to becoming an all-time great. But the problem is, the methods that made him an all-time great, or whatever he's doing at Spurs now, just aren't working. I mean, and that's a team, in so many games lately, ever since teams have, well, to be fair, ever since kind of Kane and Son have kind of, their form has dropped off a bit, but that was never going to be sustainable because they were so good early on. But teams have realised there's not that much to them in attack. And so often in games, they look lobotomised, or as if they're just trying to get it to one of the stars to do something brilliant, which of course is always going to be hit and miss. I mean, you could argue there's maybe a little bit similar with United and Bruno, but I think there's more about United at the moment. And it just looks all so lifeless and flat. Whether Levy's going to... I mean, we are at the point now where we will be talking about Mourinho's future, but from what you hear, and I think you could also see it in the Amazon documentary, there's this sense that Levy is under his spell, that Mourinho was the manager he always wanted to get. I mean, and then there was always that giveaway line in that Spurs documentary where Levy described, he was talking about the two best managers in the world. One's already in the Premier League and one is Jose Mourinho. Brilliant as Jose Mourinho once was, and he was at one point the best manager in the world. I don't think anyone can question that. He will be an all-time great. I don't think anyone serious in football was realistically saying that Mourinho was one of the two best managers in the world or anywhere close to it when Spurs appointed him in November 2019. And the brutal reality is, what is happening now is pretty much what everyone predicted would happen with Spurs when making this appointment. The only issue is, I think it's probably even quicker than everyone expected. And Spurs have themselves to blame for that. It's, I mean, it would be impressive if Mourinho gets them out of this, I have to say, but it's difficult to see right now.
Well, he's certainly got the lowest win percentage of any Spurs manager since Wande Ramos, so that probably says a lot as well. John, why simply doesn't he invest emotionally, tactically, in Gareth Bale, who actually transformed the game yesterday, and Dele Alli?
Didn't he just? I mean, Gareth Bale, I mean, it was. I was at the Emirates and so sat and watched the West Ham Spurs game its entirety before I left, and Spurs were a bit shambolic first half, and then basically second half, it was like the second coming of Gareth Bale. I mean, listen, everyone knows that the Gareth Bale we're watching now, I think even Gareth Bale and even his sort of closest allies basically would admit he's not the same player that he was. But Gareth Bale went to Spain, basically, success-wise, the greatest British export of all time, hasn't played regularly for, what, 2 years? And I just think once you sign that player, well, to give him any chance of getting back, vaguely back to where arguably I would say he was yesterday, you've got to play him. And it was borne out that he played in the week, and then basically he then comes on at halftime and was fantastic, I thought. He was the change, I think, that for Spurs, and changed the direction of travel and direction of the game. And he was so influential. He provides the corner for the goal to come back. He hits the crossbar. He's driving runs. He's impetus. Spurs came so close to getting an equaliser. And Gareth Bale was at the heart of that. And you turn him, I felt like turning around and screaming, see, Gareth Bale can still play football after all. I mean, I am Gareth Bale's biggest fan, I have to say. I don't think he's had nearly the amount of credit or respect that he's deserved for what he achieved at Real Madrid. And I just think that to do so much to get him back, I just think is a failure on the manager's part. And yes, we all know that he wants to be just right and just so to play games. But Mourinho's treatment, I think, of certain players, and this goes back to sort of Dele Alli as well, is just prehistoric. I don't think that you can treat those players like that anymore in the way that you maybe could, say, 15, 16 years ago when he was doing it at Chelsea and invoked this sort of spirit that every Chelsea player would run through brick walls for him. His famous sort of kind of untouchables remark that certain players would just always be in that team. He just can't. There's certain players that clearly love him, and look at Kane and Son I mean, they're just having the season of their lives. Højbjerg has been his signing. But his failure to do better with Dele Alli is a failure, because Dele Alli is a decisive player. Dele Alli must share some of this blame as well, because he's clearly sometimes his performance levels haven't been good enough when he has had a chance. But it's very difficult to be dropped in and out, I think, as well, and that their injuries have mounted up. Harry Winks, his treatment of it. Harry Winks is like dyed-in-the-wool Spurs fan. He's missed a Tottenham Hotspur, would die for that club, and yet has been clearly international quality player. Yeah, I just think his treatment of him and sort of total misuse and disregard of the homegrown talent like that is also is incredible. It's just unfathomable. And I think his man management is perhaps the biggest failure I can see. Because this is a team that title challenges in December. They're fall from grace. It's been spectacular. They've got the Europa League to cling to. They've got the cup final appearance to cling to. But really, this season, the goal's absolutely spot on. This season is going from bad to worse. It's really not acceptable.
And also, I mean, the League Cup will be the great defence, I suppose. But, I mean, with the greatest respect, look at the run he's had. A boy, two championship clubs. It's not exactly been the most difficult run, like, in terms of kind of putting merit and the idea of getting to a final. But beyond, I mean, just picking up on what Crossy said about man management. I think you're absolutely right. Mourinho's always had this thing where he describes as confrontational leadership, where he does things to provoke players. And that worked really well with figures like Zlatan. And I think the word Mourinho used to always describe was warriors. And he would have had that, like, say, look at the defence at Inter Milan or Chelsea. But this is a different generation of players who come through a different style of coaching. And one of the stories you already hear from around Spurs is that Mourinho tries to play what the players describe as games, where, like, you know, he's really with you one moment, and it's like someone always trying to keep you on your toes. But it's not building the connection the same way. These players don't react to it in the same way. You know, him trying to get a response, and it isn't getting a response where it matters most, the pitch.
Because when you look at it, Migs, what we're talking about here, you know, beyond the tactics board, you know, the salt and pepper pots, is actually football as a flesh and blood game. And the best managers are, you know, they use their experience wisely, they have a natural humility, but also they have an ability to actually relate to their players as fellow human beings. And, you know, when saying that, I'm talking essentially about Carlo Ancelotti. He has essentially three priorities: form relationships with his players, make sure that the owners and the board get nowhere near them. And the only way he can do that is by winning matches. So if you do that, everything falls into place. He's having a great season, isn't he?
Yeah, he is completely. And I have to say, I was a little bit sceptical of the appointments, because I think clubs like Everton that are trying to bridge gaps, I always think they should be trying to get ahead of the game and appoint, like, say, what Spurs did with Pochettino, rather than kind of managers on the way down. But at the same time, he's had a brilliant effect. The one thing I've always thought about Ancelotti, though, and that, especially as regards his relationships, and I think it's relevant to what we're talking about, the best managers of all, are the absolute all-time greats who win league title after league title, always strike me as, I mean, they're pretty intense characters. And Ancelotti, his actual league record for all the clubs he's been at isn't that brilliant. And I've often wondered whether it's almost because he's just too normal, nice a bloke to really have that kind of zealotry. And it's why players like him. I think it's possibly why his teams have done well in cups or in knockout or in the Champions League, say. And it's why everyone speaks well of him. He's just basically just a good, likable bloke. And we are seeing the positive effects of that at Everton.
Yeah, to Liverpool's detriment, certainly in the short term. Dwelling on Liverpool, as we bring this to a close, John, are Liverpool now almost beyond the point of no return this season?
Oh, well, they've still got the Champions League. I mean, I don't think defensively they're in any way good enough or reliable enough. If indeed Jordan Henderson is out for a matter of weeks, then that's a serious blow to their makeup, to their axis. Because what do they do from here? You know, they're running out of centre halves, basically. They sort of did take a couple of punts late in the window, didn't they? And it does seem inconceivable that Liverpool are in this situation whereby they left themselves with, so little options in central defence. And I think ultimately that will be their Achilles heel. You just can't possibly, I don't think, rely on sort of untried, untested players at the top end when you're trying to win the Premier League, let alone challenge in Europe. And I think they'll get undone on that. So I do think their season is beyond the point of no return, really. I mean, I'm fascinated by Thiago Alcantara because he's just one of those players that I just have loved watching up until this season. He's just one of my favourite players. He's just the way that he keeps the ball and dominates games. I just thought, oh, this will be fantastic, you know, see Liverpool play a slightly different way. But let's be honest here, they were signing a player that you have to play a different way because Liverpool were all about speed, pass and move and lightning counter-attacks. Well, that's not Thiago. And it's just not worked so far. And people are trying to find excuses for him. And I don't know that you need to find excuses for him, but just have to hold up your hands and say, well, that player at this time is not what the fit that Liverpool needed. And I think Alisson's looking vulnerable because he's not convinced about the defence in front of him. The midfield, the balance is now wrong and it's not, they're missing Henderson, but they've also got a sort of a strange component in there, which is not firing in Thiago. And the front three are lacking the same sort of supply line, but also the same confidence and belief that they had last season. I don't know that it's completely broken down in his terminal, because when you get players back, they'll improve and I think they'll go again next season. But it does bring you to a point in time when you think, is this the time when, I think Liverpool did back the manager heavily in the last transfer window, you know, £80 million odd spent in the summer. But does he need to even look at the front three to completely rebuild and to go again? And those are the sort of questions. I've no doubt that Liverpool will come back under Klopp. He's still got the energy and he's still got the drive. And I still think they will win the title again under Klopp in the future. But I do think we've reached a point in time when perhaps he needs to re-examine whether there's a complete rebuild and there's a complete new generation of a Liverpool team that needs to be rebuilt to do that.
Injuries are an obvious element of the decline, but what have they revealed in a broader sense, Migs? You know, I'm looking at their recruitment. You know, John did say, okay, they did spend money in the summer, but is the intrinsic difference between them and Man City is that City can pay 40-odd million for Nathan Ake, a centre-half, they were really unlikely to use that much, whereas, you know, essentially, Liverpool were shopping in Poundland, weren't they, in the last days of January. Is that the intrinsic difference between the two clubs?
One of them, yes. And I think you're absolutely right. And yeah, as you say, it does sum it up that the £40 million signing that City haven't really missed or haven't needed that much is pretty much precisely what Liverpool need right now and what is kind of undoing their whole season, given, the, you know, as we've discussed so many times, the effect on the whole team. I suppose there's another angle there in that when Liverpool were going very well last season, there was all the, you know, their backroom team and the recruitment was praised to the heavens as if this was all some sort of meticulous plan. I think it still indicates that, suddenly we're not so hearing so much about Michael Edwards at the moment, but I'm not, this isn't to criticise Edwards, but I think it's more so, it still proves a point that, I mean, obviously, best practice in football is to have everything very well run and to have the right structures in place, but it's still a game to a degree that is dictated by having the right manager in place. And if you have the right manager in place, it will make everything else look better. So I still think most of Liverpool's, what's happened there is still, and all success is attributable to Klopp, which is, of course, why he deserves backing now. And there is a view within the club that once they have all their players back, these problems won't look so bad. But ultimately, it is, Liverpool are one of the super clubs. They are one of those clubs that have immense global revenue beyond anyone else. But even there, there's a gap between them and Man City, which I suppose hints to some of the, maybe the potential danger of what's going to happen in English football that we're talking about. But they do have issues this season. But I do wonder, I mean, we've kind of touched on this a bit over the pod, whether this could be a Champions League season like that period between, basically, when the competition first expanded in 99 to become 32 teams and have four clubs from the top nations, And it was about 5 to 6 years there where a lot of the biggest clubs actually struggled to cope with dual demands of an expanded Champions League and a title race. And it meant you had a lot of clubs that were having bad domestic seasons or struggling winning the Champions League. Like Madrid won it when they were twice in their fifth. Milan won it, I think, when they were third and fourth. Liverpool won it when they were fifth. And it is possible, given the kind of the effect the Champions League night can have on clubs, and when they are good teams, and Liverpool remain an exceptional team, if just on a bad run and suffering issues, but they can raise it on single nights. And I think that's why maybe people are looking at them a little bit ominously as regards the Champions League, and there's the possibility we could have a 04-05 season.
That would be an interesting proposition, wouldn't it? To sum it all up, you know, we're in the decisive phase of the toughest season at the end of a brutally intense year. I think the life cycles of teams and managers have accelerated because the demands are relentless. Now, I'm not blaming Jurgen Klopp for Liverpool's problems. I'm more inclined, to be honest, to point the finger at Liverpool's owners. They probably need to invest heavily in a rebuild. Instead, it seems that John Henry, along with Joel Glazer, is preoccupied by making more money at the expense of the rest of English football. That's an imported form of greed, pure and simple. Do you agree? Please let me know either way. In the meantime, thanks to John and Miguel, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.